Well, to begin right at the beginning, the interesting thing about Melbourne is that it was an illegal settlement. We have this history of illegal settlements in Victoria, which in other states that doesn't exist. We had, first of all, the convict Buckley escaping from the Sorrento settlement, which is in 1803-4, and living for decades without, by himself or with the local Aborigines, and being rediscovered later on. Then we have illegal escaped convicts and sealers around the coasts. Then we have the Henty family illegally settling Portland in 1834. Then we have John Batman and John Pascoe Faulkner illegally settling Melbourne in 1835. And despite all that illegal history, we suddenly became very respectable and very English. And after the first land sales in 1837, when the sales were held, from 1838 onwards, there were buildings, very substantial brick buildings in the middle of nowhere. And people commented on how English this strange remote town looked. And then the third thing, I suppose, is the extraordinary change that took place with the gold discoveries. The sudden increase in population, when English people would suddenly see this as being a new world city, a city like the cities of California, a city where they had some of the first, one of the first fire brigades in Australia, where they imported ice from a long distance away and even sent it inland to the goldfields. All sorts of American notions, the Cobb and Co. coaches, and all these ideas were very unfamiliar to the English. During the 1870s, there was an increase in prosperity. Melbourne became the financial hub of Australia, and much of the pastoral settlement of Queensland, for example, was funded from Melbourne, and much of the mining in South Australia and elsewhere was controlled from Melbourne. And that fed into the boom in the 1880s, as did the amount of British investment, money flowing in through those agencies into Melbourne for those reasons. And of course, there was this boom when property values increased enormously. Skyscrapers began to be built essentially from 1886 in central Melbourne, when lifts became available, hydraulic-powered lifts. And suddenly we were building higher buildings than European cities, higher than London and elsewhere, only for a few years until the bust. But we were seen by many as being very American at that time for that reason. Then you have the Depression, which reached its nadir perhaps around about 1893, and not only did things stop, but many people immigrated. Architects especially, who depended upon development, all went to Western Australia. And many houses were left unfinished, many buildings were left vacant until after 1900. And that was a total change in the psyche of Melbourne. We suddenly became the staid, respectable British city, not the go-ahead American innovative city. I like the layers of meaning, the layers of history, which you can see as you walk around. The whole form of Melbourne today is almost totally laid down in the first 20 years. It's just got bigger and bigger and bigger in the same shape. And you can read all that into it as you walk around today. I think the most obvious ones are perhaps the terrace housing and the cast iron. To me, the most interesting, though, are the prefabricated buildings which were brought here from all over the world in the 1850s, iron buildings. There were even paper buildings, although those don't survive, and slate buildings and timber buildings and so on. I think to a specialist it would, but of course many people aren't aware of those iron buildings. But as I say, the terrace housing is much more obvious. Melbourne had its own pattern maker, so the cast iron here differs from that of, say, Sydney or New Orleans. It's rich, high Victorian iron, not imitation English old-fashioned Regency iron. Today, I think it certainly does. It's more like a big Adelaide than a small Sydney. It has the respectable sort of flat character, and none of the dramatic scenery of Sydney, but I think as a livable city, it certainly holds up, yes. How I fear it will evolve and how I think it will evolve and how I hope it will evolve are different things. We have this history of planning anarchy. That is, government bodies put out a policy and they adhere to it for a year or so, but when it comes to spending any money or exerting any political force, it all collapses again. What needs to be done is to have a revived policy of decentralisation where you encourage people to live elsewhere, as after World War II for a time, there are incentives to set up factories in the country and to encourage people to move there. Here we are now in the situation where we have run out of water and yet we go on assuming we're going to increase the population. It's what's called predict and provide. Instead of actually planning, saying we want this to happen and we'll make sure it happens, we say we think this is going to happen, we'll deal with it somehow. And it's totally uneconomic. So what should happen is that there should be a complete freeze on development of the farming lands that are being destroyed around Melbourne. There should be a limitation on the amount of population that comes into Melbourne, not by law, but by adjusting the market so that it pays the real cost of adding to the existing infrastructure. In other words, when you build a new estate, you pay your share of the original cost of the water supply and electricity and so on, so that in fact prices are allowed to rise and people have a real incentive to go somewhere else if they don't need to be in the metropolis. It'll at first apply perhaps just to retired people and a few others, but then as the population moves elsewhere, that will itself create opportunities and jobs and the prospect of opening factories in places which at present haven't got enough population. And I suppose the third thing out of all that is that within Melbourne, there needs to be a much greater emphasis on focuses of development. The idea that was supposed to underline the policy of Melbourne 2030 was to have these nodes where the public transport serviced these areas, where you could have high-rise buildings, you could have European-style living and restaurants and so on. But what's happened is that's not taken place. It hasn't taken place because the government won't either exert the legal controls or invest the money to build the new creches and libraries and things at those points. Nor have they got the courage to make the developers who develop in those areas pay for those either. So neither the government nor the private funding is coming to create these important nodes of development. There's no immediate prospect. We have two problems. The first is the politicians who don't like looking beyond the next election cycle. The second is the planners who have lost their vision of what planning is to be. When town planning was first introduced here, which was essentially after World War II, planning was seen to be a rather socialist activity where you distributed the goods across the community in the best possible way. Now it seemed to be a task of facilitating development. It's assumed the planner's job is to pave the way for new development. I think it's possible to do, and a lot has been done surprisingly in China to imitate these community areas of Western cities, so it's possible to do it artificially. But bear in mind at the moment, those areas you speak about, like Carlton, are a very small minority of Melbourne. There are huge tracts of population who live in these bleak suburbs with bleak spreading shopping centres and no public transport. And there are many, many people who never come to the city or come once a year to a musical. And our picture of Melbourne from the centre is a very distorted picture. Certainly as a historian, I want to emphasise these imported buildings, which really are extraordinary because there's nowhere else in the world where there are so many or were so many of these imported buildings. Prefabrication is always interesting technically. It involves the most advanced building technology to create these structures that can be taken apart and moved. But its motivation is economic. It's always economic in that you depend upon having a market that can pay more for these buildings, and the cost of labour being high here and the cost of labour being low at the place where they're being made. And they were first done on a large scale by the British sending buildings to California for the Californian Gold Rush. But they were all destroyed, mostly by the fires in San Francisco. And we had many more come here. So A, California ones were destroyed. B, we had more of them here. And a surprising number survive. They keep being discovered. The iron buildings we know about because everyone can recognise an iron building. And there are a number of those. But the timber buildings just appear out of nowhere. They've been altered and reclad. And suddenly you find inside a structure the remains of one of these unique buildings. Some of those have been Singapore-made buildings with Chinese markings on the timber. And they don't survive anywhere else in the world. Well, there are none, obviously, in the city. The biggest houses are Caraya Villa at Geelong, which is a very grand house made of solid plate iron, and the house Tintern in Toorak, which is similar but not quite so ornate. There are smaller corrugated iron, more shed-like houses. The National Trust has a property in South Melbourne where they have one on its original site and two buildings they've moved to the site. There are the timber buildings, including Latrobe's Cottage, which is a wooden panelised building imported in 1839. The Singapore houses, there's one in St Kilda which you just wouldn't recognise from the outside. Others have been rescued after demolition, have been moved onto a private property so you don't see them. There's a big two-storey prefabricated house in Coburg. In fact, there are two. There's one American one and one British one. There are so many examples. There are a lot of new mansions which one doesn't much like, pseudo-French chateau mansions and neo-Georgian mansions. But the truth of the matter is the mansions of the 19th century were no better on average. There was as much bad taste and vulgarity and nouveau-riche crassness about them. Some are very beautiful, but many are just really quite ordinary, and just because they've become a bit rarer, they're now valued, which is reasonable enough. What happened in Melbourne, which was distinctive, was the extent to which we became a suburban city. The suburb, as it originated, was literally what it meant, below the town. And it was a pocket. So outside London, you have suburban development along the Thames at Chiswick and that sort of thing. But in Melbourne, the whole ring of suburbs was beginning to develop by the 1850s. People spoke about the novelty of the smiling parterres, the lawns and clipped flower beds of these new areas. And the detached house became much more common than it is in most cities. And even while the terrace house was rising through the second half of the 19th century, these more spread out suburbs were developing. After 1900, when terrace housing became unfashionable and the idea of the garden city became important and cars became available, of course, suburbia boomed. And since that time almost, architects have hated it. They've regarded suburban spread as being not communal, not the sort of central, you know, town square development you want, and haven't liked it. But in fact, it's the mode of life which has made Melbourne what keeps being referred to as the most livable city, or one of the most livable cities in the world. The idea that you can have your own bit of land, you can garden in the back or build your boat in the back, and you're monarch of all your survey, essentially, it's critical. And the suburban dream of owning your own quarter-acre block, in theory, though none of them are actually quarter-acre, still persists. Fewer and fewer of our young people will ever afford to own such a house, but many of them at the moment still think they might. What's going to happen is, over time, not that the dream will change, but the age at which you attain it, if ever, will gradually rise until it becomes much more the exception than the rule. The biggest mistake in the recent planning in Melbourne, I think, has been the Charles Grimes Bridge. Whereas in Sydney, you can bring a tourist liner, giant international liner, into the passenger terminal, and the tourists step straight off and go to restaurants and go around the town. And we could have done that with the Docklands here. That's no longer possible. And that was an extraordinary decision to put a bridge across the Arrow so low that you can't bring a tourist ship into the heart of the city. I think the pride is justified. I think the claims about it being most livable have been grossly exaggerated. There have been, you know, there was one survey years ago that made us the third most livable or something, and suddenly we keep on saying we're the best. But there's certainly a distinctive quality about suburban life, certainly that Melbourne in particular has a depth of culture that most Australian cities at least don't have. And overseas visitors are regularly impressed by the pleasantness of the terrace housing in the inner suburbs, which they find surprising. I don't think the grand mansions are so remarkable. The ones that we refer to as mansions here are not unlike big suburban houses around Oxford and places in England. They're nice, but they're not so unique. But Melbourne has certainly got quite a distinctive character, yes.